morning. You're listening to the Friday 8 o'clock Buzz. My name is Sholly Pittman. Our producer is Austin Exum. Well, looking ahead to today's show, you know, we usually do local stuff, Madison, Dane County, South Central Wisconsin. But today is a little more focused on world events. If you're like me, you were up late on Wednesday evening looking at what is happening in Ukraine, Russian aggression against Ukraine. And so we're going to spend the hour talking about different perspectives on that. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll have an interview with Adrienne Kochman. She's curator at the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art in Chicago. We talked last night and recorded it. We were in conversation about art in the context of war and also Ukrainian artists who are worth paying attention to, especially in this moment. But first, starting off in a few minutes, we're going to lay out the situation. What is going on in Ukraine? If you're searching for information online, how do you know it's not disinformation? I've already been tricked. I bet you have been, too. How does the media factor into all of it? We're going to hear from Professor Benjamin Peters. He's a media scholar and expert on this region of the world. So, yeah, that's a lot coming up. It's an international show here on the Friday 8 o'clock Buzz with some local ties. Our first guest this morning is a media scholar who spends a lot of time thinking about the intersection of media, digital media, and Russia. We're talking about information in this digital age. So Dr. Benjamin Peters is an associate professor at the University of Tulsa, where he's the chair of the Media Studies Department, and he's author of several books, among them How Not to Network a Nation, The Uneasy History of the Soviet Internet. And as we look at what is happening in Ukraine, the Russian invasion of many cities in Ukraine, and we watch it from afar, we have that strange experience of watching news reports or reading our news, which our guest is going to tell us that what we should do in reading our news. But as we scroll through social media, maybe we don't know quite what to approach as real and what's not. So we're going to talk about all of that. But first, I should say hello, Dr. Benjamin Peters. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Good morning. Hello.
Hello.
So glad to be with you.
So starting out, can we talk about, can we just lay out the situation on the ground? It feels like, you know, I wake up in the morning and the situation is a bit different. There's people in Inner Kyiv, you know, now this morning who are witnessing fighting, I believe. Can you just start off on the ground, giving us a little bit of the background of this situation? You know, we've heard language about an armed conflict for a long time for Putin, and obviously there are this extends back decades, right? But just a few days ago, we kind of saw the other foot drop. So what is the context of what we are seeing right now?
Thank you, Sholly. So this morning, this is indeed a rapidly evolving situation. And anybody who's watching the news is watching the expansion of land troops and deeply worried about troops on the ground from Russia and how far they're going to get. But as for the context, I think what we are seeing in the last 3 or 4 days is this unprecedented and almost within modern history since World War II, save the Balkans, unprecedented European land war. That began 3 days ago in earnest, but has roots dating back at least 14 years and even more closer to 30. So Ukraine has the troubled, if still wonderful, situation of being an independent nation, often without a state to support it, on and off for several hundred years. Probably to understand what makes up the Ukraine nation and its culture, we needed to say two things simultaneously. One is that, independent of any history, it, like all nations, has a right to its own sovereign territory and the right to its own self-determination. And that simple fact is what makes the current events just so harrowing and so fundamentally tragic. If we look at the much longer history, we realize that Ukraine is indeed a complex, multicultural crossroads of many former empires, never its own Ukrainian empire, never a superpower, but nevertheless pivotal in the crossroads of Europe and Eurasia. Once under the Soviet Union in the 20th century, and before that, often influenced directly by the Polish-Lithuanian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, the remnants of the Holy Roman Empire. The Western cultural capital, Lviv, for example, has been named, five different names in the last five centuries. And as such, remains a kind of, it's not subject to these other countries. It's this beautiful salad bowl of different influences. So I think to understand in a nutshell, we have to acknowledge that Ukraine plays a really important geopolitical role as this intersection of many former empires. And what we're seeing today in the last few days is the extraordinary and devastating overreach of one of those empires into a space that it wrongly considers its own.
I want to talk about the initial events on, for us, it was Wednesday evening, almost Thursday morning, as some cities began to have, fire and acts of war, Putin delivered an address, right, over television at the same time in, I think, yesterday or following that, shortly after, was an address from the Ukrainian president, right, Volodymyr Zelensky, who is an interesting figure himself, right, and addressing the Russian people and calling for them not to abide this, right, recognizing that this would not be aired on Russian television, but calling on them to oppose this. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little more about the actors here. Of course, we are all familiar with Putin, but who is Zelensky and what is the context there in terms of how this was announced and the response?
Yeah, thank you. That's very thoughtful. The big picture is that there is, of course, a coordinated attack across many fronts here. So there's, in addition to media disinformation and pushing channels and ways that will are meant to influence public opinion across the nations, there's also cyber attacks at the same time that there's military attacks. So to your points about the timing of Putin and Zelensky's talks, I think there's some varying context here. So again, before we zoom into the talks, we should note that this attack is happening several days after the wrapping up of the Olympics, which is actually the same timing back in 2014, just a couple days after the international spotlight moved away from the Olympics, or in Eurasia in this case, away from China. We're seeing a kind of deliberate and motivated attack then, which I think is in part meant to divert attention. Excuse me.
No worries.
Simultaneously, I think we're also just on the moment of timing, and this has nothing to do with media or disinformation. It's just the tragic, horrific shadow that this attack is casting. Russia has a history of trying to win wars and often winning wars in the cold. It failed against the Finns, but otherwise it has a kind of glorious history of out surviving Februarys against other armies. And I think there's something intolerably calculated about the amount of human suffering that a February attack can cause, right? The amount of hunger and famine, to the degree this invasion succeeds, will produce, it could be catastrophic. And I already am deeply worried about many of my friends and colleagues in the region who are abandoning large cities and hiding out in dachas, which are not intended for February living. To the timing of the talks, I think it's worth noting that, these have fundamentally differing attitudes. Nobody is really inside the head of Putin anymore. It's hard to know exactly where he's coming from. But the false tales, the dis and misinformation that he is laying out, the kind of abusive narrative where he's blaming the victims for the cause of the attack, it's just patently horrific. We've seen him in his measured, calm, kind of dull, calculating way lay out a narrative that that blames Ukraine for Russian aggression. Zelensky's talk, on the other hand, was a breath of fresh air. Zelensky is not a traditional politician. He's a comedian. He's an actor from television. And as in the strange world of mediated politics in the last 20 years, you know, we see Schwarzenegger's and Ronald Reagan, a B-actor movie, moving into positions of power. He, you know, was once played a president on TV before he became a real president. And I think his talk, even though it didn't reach Russians through formal channels, is definitely reaching the Russian people. And here, as your distinction made, that the talk was moving and heartfelt appeal to the Russian people, drawing on and reversing the horrific narrative that Putin's offering, which is that Ukraine is subordinate to this little brother, Mala Russia, to the great Russia. Instead, Zelensky is saying, indeed, we are united, and that every time Russia invades Ukrainian, Russia also invades every Ukrainian inside every Russian, right? And I think that's, you're seeing resonance there. You're seeing the Russian people respond in very different ways on average than Putin and his militarized state. So it's hard to know exactly how this is going to split. I imagine that there's a large group of the Russian population that is going to be pro-Putin almost no matter what. But there's also a generation or two of emerging public resistance from younger people, from people who read independent channels and have their eye on the international press and are getting their information outside of Russian state media. So who knows how it's going to go forward, but there's this complex situation, I think, is definitely a story not only of tanks, but of channels.
And I want to respond to what you said at the beginning. I'm sorry to hear about your colleagues. I hope they are doing okay. And that's part of what makes this so difficult for many, right, is this the wave of information of what is happening on the ground is often, it's piecemeal. It's hard to verify every situation. And I was talking with someone else who yesterday in researching the show, who told me, you know, the phone is the best way to get information. You don't know what's happening on social media. Some people are being blocked from posting for 12 hours just because the infrastructure goes out or they're not able to access it. So that can be really difficult. And I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
And I want to talk a little bit about the role of the Russian kind of state media and alternatives outside of that. As you said, dissent is difficult, right? It's something that will get you arrested in Russia. So, can we talk a little bit about the different avenues here and what is happening on Russian television?
The Russian state television right now is it's fairly abysmal. I mean, it's just awful. Let me note that, and I don't mean to point, a false equivalency, but many large state media in many places are selling their own stories, right? So that's not unique. Excuse me. What we're seeing in RT or Pierwszy Kanal, the first channel, the Russian state media television channel, is an extraordinarily uniform and univocal, monolithic narrative that is trying to turn fact into fiction, right? So that if you've watched the main television channels, you're seeing that Ukraine and the Ukrainian governments are the aggressors, that West is pushing for the conflict, that Russia's just redeploying its troops on its own territory, not within other people's territories. The patent horrible lies. The United States is planning chemical attacks, that Russia is only moving in to defend ethnic Russians within Ukraine. Right. There are no credible reports to any of these kind of false flag narratives that are the pretext for justifying an invasion. And it's been horrific that there could be such like a monolithic, univocal position on this. Again, I want to point out that I think largely national media in the West, I have been watching BBC in Ukrainian. Right, that's one of the sources that I'm following. I'm also following the Interfax in Ukrainian. It also has its own story, but its story, unlike the extreme, is based largely in verifiable fact. But that doesn't mean there isn't a narrative, right? So I think for me, one of the key points for being able to sort disinformation is to be able to look bias in the face and not panic, right? We have to all acknowledge that there are different types of bias and that each of us has our own. And if we can sit with that without panic, we've made the first, we've reoriented ourselves towards being able to be more healthy and wise information consumers.
Yeah, I was looking up Ukraine, Russia fact checks, and there are already so many, right? Of that thing that you saw on social media was old footage, you know, from 2 years ago, right? That is not accurate. I want to also talk about the role of coordinated disinformation campaigns and the fact of seeing things on social media, and that there are actual coordinated bad actors on social media whose sole intent is to justify what is happening or cause chaos and disinformation. Can you talk about, I saw on Twitter, you know, folks reminding their followers not to to verify everything that they are seeing and to be very wary of things that don't have attribution, typical journalism media literacy things, right? But especially in this context, I also saw Twitter tweeting out information about in Ukrainian about how to delete your account, which I don't quite understand. Can you talk about these online spaces and camp there?
Thank you. What a lovely question. It is vital. I mean, every one of us has a role in this conflict, if only to be better stewards of ourselves and to approach an information ecosystem in a more responsible and sustainable way. So this is exactly what role each of us can be playing. Let me offer three tips that I think will help us navigate. I hope they're memorable. The first is to check your source. The second is to check yourself. And the third is to check the time before you share or believe anything that you're reading on social media. So by source, I mean simply, does the person that you're getting this information from have a legitimate reason to know anything about it? Your uncle that you see over Thanksgiving only and has, you know, a real estate job in a random American city probably does not have a legitimate right to be espousing or propagating some meaningful source. If you can instead back up your sources until you find a knowable, credible expert and share their information, that's a step forward. The second is to check yourself, by which I mean one of the best things we can do is not rapid share in a flash of panic or anger. Clickbait is designed to emote, get emotional reactions out of us. And because it knows that we'll share in the heat of anger or frustration. And if we can instead just check ourselves and only share once we've, you know, double or triple checked something. A really good way, again, to balance both of these is to take enough time to, once you see an extraordinary story, go see if you can find that story again from another credible source. Play the political biases against each other. If you can find it the Financial Times, can you find it in the Washington Post? If you see it in The Economist, can you find it in The Atlantic? Or, you know, and for the love of all that's holy, avoid, you know, the extreme media sources. Do not be playing with OAN or Newsmax or, you know,
Fox
they're just,
News. Yeah.
They're unwedded from fact. Fox News, you know, they're unwedded from fact. They have no obligation. Facts cannot sue for libel, and there's no obligation to stick with facts. So keep yourself sane. And the third, of course, is to check the time, to consider, like, is there a reason that sharing this might serve a narrative or an advantage, someone in this particular case? Is there, for example, I was talking with friends recently who are sowing kind of narratives that blamed Biden or, you know, the fact that he didn't show strength or something for the Russian invasion, which just strikes me as a kind of weak attempt to sow dissension in the very moment that we're actually seeing the, you know, within the political forces in America, a unity and a strength for the first time, perhaps horrifically, since the Cold War. I'd certainly hope that a unifying enemy is not what we need to come together as a country, but it does appear that this is a moment of strength and, you know, coalition building after such, you know, so many years and decades of internal fighting. Yeah. So,
and I'd add one more, is that forecasting is kind of the lowest form of journalism, right? People who project to know what's in the future don't. We're running out of time, but yep. I do want to thank you so much for joining us. Do you have any last thoughts, you know, 20 seconds, last thoughts?
Thank you, Shelley. The Ukraine is a beautiful territory. It deserves our attention as Americans, as listeners. Let us, you know, attend to the world and care for it. The cost at the pump, indeed, may go up, but that is a small price to pay compared to the horrific costs of a war that we need to avoid.
Benjamin Peters, thank you so much. And I wish we could have you on for longer. We're limited by our pre-record time in the next half, but I would love to have you back. Benjamin Peters is professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa, where he studies technology and our online ecosystem. He is an affiliated fellow of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. He's author of several books. Check him out. The latest is Your Computer is on Fire from MIT Press. It's a collection of essays on inequities and biases woven into our technological system. You can follow him on Twitter, an actually trusted account, BJ Peters, and you can find him online at benjaminpeters.org. Coming up next, we're going to be speaking with Adrian Kochman. Moving right along into the show, because we don't have a lot of time, well, what do you do when war breaks out across the world, or halfway across the world? Like many, I spent hours scrolling through Twitter, and we were just warned not to do that, but watching the news to the point where that I could not sleep. But one thing that you can do is run to art to help make sense of these times. So yesterday I called up Adrian Kochman, who is the curator at the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art in Chicago, who is very kindly agreed to talk with me yesterday evening, even as she kept track of the statuses of friends and colleagues in Ukraine and nearby. I hope you enjoy this interview. And as a note, Dr. Kochman will list the names of several Ukrainian artists and art galleries who have been trying to make sense of this conflict for years and years and years. I highly recommend that you take note and check them out, because art can be an entirely different window, perhaps a more thoughtful one, into what can feel like an alternate universe. Is that a deal? Deal. Okay, now on with that interview. Yesterday, Ukrainians in Chicago gathered in the Harlem Avenue overpass to protest the Russian invasion of their homeland. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, about 54,000 people of Ukrainian heritage live in the Chicago area. And if you go to Chicago, at the heart of the Ukrainian village in Chicago's Westtown neighborhood is the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art. Joining me on the line is the museum's curator, Dr. Adrian Kochman. Adrian, thank you for talking with me.
Thank you.
We talked a little bit this afternoon about doom scrolling as news pours in, and worrying about loved ones in Ukraine and nearby. Tell us how you're doing this week and in the last day and a half in particular.
It's been a roller coaster, to be honest. None of us are really sleeping. Some are glued to the TV or computers, even Instagram, you know, following accounts of people we know there, to try and get information that's accurate, and generally the kind of personal stories, you know, people we know will report what they're seeing, or they'll videotape and post. This morning, you just start over again. You know, you just try to get more information, figure out what's going on. And, you know, on a personal side, I'll be honest, this is in the midst of fits of crying from the stress, the anguish, the pain. We've got friends there. You know, I wonder where they're hiding, what they're doing. I can't reach them. Some are professional colleagues. You know, a cousin of mine, sort of twice removed, is not in the fighting area, but I wonder how she's doing with her family. I have a cousin here in the States who's in touch with her, so I'll find out from him. But everything kind of takes time. Trolling on the web, as you said, is, you know, just getting that information takes time, and sorting out, you know, getting information that you want to, that seems confirmed or is confirmed, is actually kind of a relief to know. It doesn't feel so in the kind of doomsday ether. It just feels kind of tangible. But the information is, it's scary. I mean, one post, I can't even remember whose it was anymore, but they were posting what to do if there's bombing in your city, you know, and how to protect yourself in your apartment, or, you know, if you don't have a basement, you know, you're not in a home, how do you protect yourself? And so from glass being blown out, when the windows get blown out, and so there were steps, hide here. You know, it's like our kind of tornado warning drills that we have here.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, in the Chicago area, we have with instructions, okay, the siren goes off, you know what to do. You run to your basement. You don't stay away from the southwest corner of your home, or you stay near in that corner. I can't remember at the moment, but those kind of instructions. Or I was looking at a Facebook page of an artist I know, and she was posting the latest information of invasion in the Mariupol area, because he happened to be there, and it was like, this is confirmed, this is not confirmed. So it varies, and sources are located all over the country. You get different pieces of information. You have to kind of put it together. And it supplements what you hear on the news. It adds more perspective, and it's very strange, to be honest. I mean, it's a war, and it just feels strange to kind of be here and kind of knowing what everyone's going through. And I was last there in October of 2020 in Kyiv. So all these pictures of Independence Square, I know where that is. I know the proximity of one area, how many blocks it is from one area to another. I know the depths of the metro station. So when these are now like bomb shelters, the president declared them bomb shelter, I think last week already, or even 2 weeks ago, that people could hide there. And they're unbelievably deep. So I don't know, I can just kind of imagine it in some sort of tangible way without being there. Of course, I'm not there. I mean, you know, this is my imagination.
You know, I think there are a lot of emotions right now, and I want to thank you for hopping on even when, you know, you are dealing with so much. I don't think we're meant to take in this much this information at once, kind of looking at a screen or listening to the radio or looking, you know, watching television. I think you used the term focused stress, and I think that's very accurate, right? Interspersed with like the banality of everyday life. It's a very weird place for me, and I'm sure so much more for you, having this community, this heritage, this friends, loved ones. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask you how the arts community, you know, you're a curator, right? And art plays such a vital role, even though right now it can seem like maybe not as relevant in the midst of, you know, news and politics and straight news reporting. But I wanted to ask you how the arts community that you're a part of is responding to Russia's aggression.
You know, it's interesting. It's hard to, I don't know, it's hard for me to say I'm part of a community, because our, you know, UIMA, the Ukrainian Institute, is kind of in this in-between zone. I mean, we're very focused on contemporary art that's not just Ukrainian. We show, you know, contemporary art by anybody. You don't have to be connected to being Ukrainian, although a big portion of our permanent collection is by contemporary Ukrainian artists. And we see ourselves as, you know, kind of, you know, if you want information about Ukraine, come to us about contemporary art. Certainly if you're in the Chicago or Midwest area, we can facilitate that. And I would say, you know, I'll tell you, after our conversation this afternoon, I received a statement through a colleague of mine in New York who is in touch with the art arsenal, and it was a military arsenal decades ago, and was converted into a huge art space that is almost like football stadium size. It's enormous. And all kinds of art events occur there. There's a book fair, there are poetry readings, there are art exhibits that rotate. There are all kinds of events there. And the statement by the director was very much about how to kind of, what they're going to do kind of to move forward, that it's not about the aggression or fighting back. They hope that they can do their programming this spring, but they really don't know what to expect. And they, right now, they're trying to keep friends, family safe, also protect the art collections because they're in Kyiv. And so if it gets invaded or bombed, they want to protect Ukraine's artistic heritage. So they have to find secure spaces where they can be stored and preserved long term. But one thing that I thought she said that was really important about art was that she kept emphasizing arts and culture and publishers and, writers and actors and theater directors and just the arts in general and musicians, and how the arts are really a place of civility and dignity and trust and democracy, so that they're a kind of safe zone for open thinking and not about aggression. I mean, what we've done at the Institute on our end is organize or host. Sometimes we in-house curate, sometimes we co-curate. There are various sort of scenarios about how these exhibits are developed. But we host exhibits about events and things that are occurring in Ukraine. And in 2019, we had an exhibit by a New York Times photographer who's been stationed in Kyiv, who called Brotherland. He was sent on assignment, actually, to the Donbas area to photograph troops fighting. I mean, he had some security clearance. He could get in kind of militarized zones. And so he came, he showed his work, he spoke, and really illustrating the messiness of the war that he'd been covering there, which has been ongoing since 2014.
This has been building up over a very long time, right? This language has been used by Putin and others for a very long time. There have been warning signs. It's been an escalation in language, and now it's action, right? I'm wondering if you can talk about some of the artists that you look at who are objecting to aggression, if you could tell us, some people to follow. You are a curator.
Yeah. Well, the number one person that I met, I respect her work, is Vlada Ralko. Vlada is V-L-A-D-A, and then her last name is Ralko, R-A-L-K-O. And she's highly respected in the entire country. I mean, everybody really looks up to her because she actually, in 2014, during the Maidan protests, she documented that whole experience and what it was like from the December protests. Well, they began in December, I should say, in 2013, and then continued. And she drew 400... She had 400 sheets of paper, drew on them every day, and developed what's called the Kyiv Diary. And she was able to both document kind of the reality of war, being kind of sitting there and drawing, but at the same time, the chaos of it in a subjective way. But her drawings are, they're like so choppy and kind of hackneyed. They're metaphors that you can't really take them literally because they're kind of body parts with a helmet on and, someone's sticking their tongue out. And the emotional content of the work illustrates kind of grief and dismay and what war is like. And often her illustrations are paired with the writings of Andrei Kurkov, whose work we can get in English. His work has been translated, and he wrote Ukraine Diaries, which was published in 2014. And, you know, I looked it up here on, actually on Google. There's just a few lines that I think kind of illustrates the really just surreal, odd experience of what war is like. If I could just,
please do.
Read it. Quote, it's minus 16 degrees Celsius, sunlight, silence. I drove the children to school, then went to see the revolution. I walked between the tents, talked with the revolutionaries. They were weary today. The air was thick with the smell of old campfires. It's just so bizarre. You know, that's end quote. And his apartment was 500 yards from Independence Square. He could smell the burning barricades, hear the sound. I'm quoting here from Google, the burning barricades and hear the sounds of grenades and gunshots. And this is actually the same time period that Vladarelko illustrates. So often you pair them together where his writing, you know, he's writing a kind of narrative about how disjointed his day is. And Rauko's writing about, she was trying to focus on the reality of the war, but then she also interprets it in her drawings in ways that are, you know, kind of illustrate, I think, actually, the, you know, what we've been talking about, this kind of doomsday trolling, and your mind kind of wanders in and out, and your focus is off. It kind of comes in and out, and then you, you know, pace around your apartment or outside, or, you know, we're at work and, you know, on the phone talking to colleagues or getting information. You put your phone down and you walk to and sharpen pencils. And then, you know, because you need to do something that is like mundane and basic and doesn't have any connection to the war or the stress of it. It's just, or, you know, you're at home and you start dusting, you know, something, and then you go back and you take the next call, or you read the, you know, if you're working remotely and you see the next email and a colleague is sending you an email, you know, wishing you, you know, hoping that you're okay, or, you know, empathizing with you. I think, you know, I think I had, you know, here was a colleague who's Lithuanian, and she wrote to me a few hours ago. She said, "You've been in my thoughts and heart for the past several weeks, now in fear and pain. I got an email from a friend in Vilnius today," and that's in Lithuania, "that her cousin in Kyiv reported bombing last night. The cousin's family wants to flee to Lithuania to their brother's home, but have a 90-year mother to tend. So much anguish, hard to believe the Russians are doing it again in solidarity." And by doing it again, she's referring to, this is a repeat of like World War II. And this idea of fleeing and, you know, having your 90-year-old mother, grandmother, and will she come with you? Or is she going to decide to just ride it out because her life is near its end, and what's the point of fleeing? Which is what happened to my great-great-grandmother, actually. My mother's Ukrainian, and she had to flee during World War II when she was about 9 years old. And her great-grandmother, who lived with her family and was, you know, her nana, you know, her grandmother and her source of affection and everything. And she decided to stay because she was so old. She's like, what am I going to leave for? She figured she'd probably be a burden to the family because they escaped in cars. And she decided not to go with them. And my mother cried for days. Yeah, and they never knew what happened to her. And this is, it just reminds, I mean, everyone in the community has stories like this. that's of that generation. I mean, the Institute was founded by World War II refugees.
Yeah,
I mean, it was in 1971, but it was at a time when they had stabilized enough in the Ukrainian community in Chicago to be able to think about, hey, maybe we'll do, you know, have an art space. And that was really on the heels of, you know, the end of the civil, or kind of, you know, American civil rights movements, women's rights movements. A lot of arts organizations were organizing, small ones, you know, for performance art, women's art, cooperatives. Lots of ethnic museums were established then in Chicago, too. Some already started in the 60s, but like alternative art spaces. So the Ukrainian Institute was a small, like, do-it-yourself space in a two-flat or three-flat, I think, on Chicago Avenue. And they were so successful, popular. They started a permanent collection, and about 7 years, 8 years later, they moved into the space they have now and had to expand that.
That was that brought us full circle and right back to the museum. And first, I just want to say that is an impossibly difficult family history, and I'm so sorry. And talking about the museum, I'm wondering if you can tell us just a little more for those who might not be familiar with the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art. I had the pleasure of going a couple of years ago, and I saw works by Ukrainian artists and then also works that were not. I think when I traveled, there were works by, it was like a community project from artists with disabilities, and it was very cool.
Oh, yeah. And yeah.
And so that probably gives you a window of when I was there, but it's an interesting way of hanging on to one's heritage, right? Of preserving one's heritage of some Ukrainian art mixed with the community that you're in now in Chicago of local artists. So for those who are interested in visiting the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art, can you just let us know where exactly it's located in the Ukrainian village and just how people can access it?
Sure. Well, our website, which is always helpful, I think, is, you know, www.uima-chicago.org. And our address is 2320 West Chicago Avenue. Entrance to the Institute is free. You know, there's a donation box if you feel like donating something, but you don't have to. Our exhibits, there's a permanent collection exhibit on display that rotates every 6 months or so. Every so often, a special exhibit will be installed there if one arises. Sometimes those are actually coming from Ukraine. Like we had a contemporary graphics from Ukraine exhibit a couple of years ago, which was installed there, which was just, it was wonderful. And then in the West Gallery, those are temporary rotating exhibits that run about every 8 weeks. And those are all kinds of just various subjects. I mean, the show that you saw was A is for Artists, which was an exhibit of artists or persons with disabilities making art. I think four or five organizations in the Chicago area. And actually it raised issues kind of about what is contemporary art, because there weren't strict ideas about how to make art in that exhibit, and they're not necessarily strict ideas anymore about what contemporary art is either. So it raised really interesting conversations about what art is and who can make it and, you know, what qualifications you need to have and who sees it and such. And we have all kinds of exhibits coming in. They're not strictly one particular. They're not only painting. You'll see sculpture. You'll see installations. We're actually, this is something we're still hoping will happen, but I've been in conversation with the Yara Arts Group in New York City, which is a theater arts group, and we are partnering with them to bring in a show from that will also be in Ukraine at the Arsenal for 2023, based on the art director Les Courbus's play Gas. which was actually staged at the Goodman Theater in Chicago in the mid-1920s. I think it was 1925. So we were going to recreate the staging of it at the Institute in 2023. And, you know, if things ease up in Ukraine, we hope to still be able to do that project.
And that kind of brings me to maybe my last question is, it's impossible to say what art is being made right now, because mm-hmm. it's being made right now in the midst of this dark period. But as you think about curating this moment, do you have any perspective on what you would look for and what you would want to highlight? Or is it still too rough and new and who knows?
You know, it is rough and new, but I'm already starting to collect imagery. At least, you know, I don't know what will be available in terms of getting the work here, because war disrupts shipping. And we already had that with COVID. I mean, COVID essentially shut down shipping abroad because of not only costs, but delays with customs. Internationally, countries had different COVID policies for accepting goods and shipping out goods. And war will do that also. So I don't know what kind of exhibit we will have, but I'm already, I would say, collecting imagery off, you know, kind of social media from artists I know or galleries whose work I follow, or, you know, like the Arsenal. I know those, you know, who those artists are, and I will look and so on. And there's one artist who spray painted kettlebells, which, you know, are like for working out, in blue and yellow, which are the colors of the Ukrainian flag. And he was, you know, anyone could do this, you know, we could do this at home, but it's really to show strength and kind of might to fight back.
That was an interview with Dr. Adrian Kochman, a curator at the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art, as we wrap up the show today. This has been the Friday 8 o'clock Buzz. I want to thank our crew this morning, Ankur Malhotra, our DJ, our engineer, Jim Wilson, and producer Austin Exum. Thanks also to Talk Director Rochelle Wilson for lending the great idea to talk to our first guest, and thank you to our guests. Thanks for listening this morning. I'm your host, Shali Pittman.